Hello, this is Chris with the Bloomington Pentagraph for Monday, November 17th. We'll begin today's reading on the front page. Growers weigh risks and reward. Farmers plant cover crops, face risks to enrich fields. Farmers planting cover crops, which can include cereal rye, winter wheat, and other grasses and legumes, for better water filtration and weed suppression, also face challenges such as time, cost, risk, and labor. But many say they are willing to take the risk to help enrich and protect their fields between harvest and planting seasons. Tom Leeper, who farms in Macon County, has been growing cover crops on 50% of his acreage. He determines which ground is seeded for cover crops based on what ground is most vulnerable and uses a winter kill mix of oats, radishes, and rapeseed, which is applied aerially when the previous crop is still standing. Applying cover crops have provided better erosion control from wind and water, and they contribute to organic matter in the soil. Some of the land he works is close to woodlands, so cover crops are helping with wildlife habitat too. Farm profits play a role in his decisions as well. I've seen really good yieldability after cover crops, he said. Tim Rainbutt, director of field operations at University of Missouri Extension, said incentives for farmers have made it possible for farmers to plant cover crops because it makes it more financially feasible. I'm amazed that program incentives are working to get people to plant cover crops. It's a tough economy, but if they have incentives, they will. Rainbot also said some farmers have been utilizing drones to help them plant cover crops, which he believes will increase their adoption. Doug Adams farms in north central Iowa and started using cover crops in the fall of 2012. I put them on every acre I have, he said. He usually plants winter rye or winter wheat into corn stalks, but this year he decided to add hairy vetch too. Adams started planting his cover crops by broadcasting via airplane, but he switched to drilling and plants his soybeans in the spring with the same drill. He grows no-till soybeans and is starting to do more no-till corn. Cover crops and no-till go together like peanut butter and jelly, Adams said, and as he adds more land, he applies the system to new fields. The advantages are visible. He saw an increase in earthworms not long after he started using cover crops. He said he gets more weed control if he grows cover crops later into the spring, and so he delays terminating them. Cover crops keep it drier in the spring, but can conserve moisture in the summer as mulch. He said some farmers have concerns about terminating cover crops by a certain time, but he has never had a failure. If the weather is cold, however, it can take longer to terminate them. Jim Cudback, who farms in southeast Iowa, has been planting cover crops on his acres for 13 years and applies them with a broadcast seeder in front of his tractor. He uses cereal rye because it has a good stand and has good weed control. Cudback said cover crops have improved the soil health in his fields and helped to improve his bean yields. Cereal rye roots go down, and the roots decay and let moisture infiltrate. In northwest Missouri, Ryder Jackson said he has been planting cover crops for 5 or 6 years and switches between cereal rye and wheat on all ground with corn going into soybeans. He uses an air seeder to plant them, and since starting, he said he has noticed better water filtration, weed suppression, and erosion control. Jackson said the cost of planting cover crops, coupled with the time and labor costs, are a challenge for his operation. He uses two different programs to help him pay for the expense. And from Springfield, transit bill funds new train routes. Peoria Quad Cities may benefit from fund backing passenger rail. With money for new rail lines, regulations for residential development projects, and a list of infrastructure priorities in the Chicago area, a public transportation bill recently approved in Springfield does more than just fill a transit funding gap. While Senate Bill 2111 was widely covered for the $1.5 billion it drives to transit throughout Illinois and its governance reforms in the Chicago region, the more than 1,000-page bill outlines a new approach to public transportation. And it includes new regulations designed to spark development near transit stops and bring passenger rail service to new cities. Two regions, Peoria and the Quad Cities, could be the largest downstate communities to benefit from the bill. It allows the Illinois Department of Transportation to use up to $476 million from a pair of downstate public transportation funds to build new passenger rail routes from Chicago. Bill supporter Senator Mike Halpin said in an October 31st news conference that would cover the remaining cost of a long-planned project to establish a train route from Chicago to the Quad Cities. The project still has a long way to go, and there is no time frame for when people might be able to ride a train from the Moline to Chicago. The biggest hurdle remains reaching an agreement with the Iowa Interstate Railroad, which operates the tracks that a passenger train would have to use to make the route a reality. Funding for the project has been elusive, and Halpin said stakeholders have become frustrated that freight rail companies have not committed to funding part of the project. We decided this was an opportunity that we needed to do, and the state and local governments could go it alone to fund this project. But House Minority Leader Tony McCombie said during debate over the bill in the House on October 31st that there is still no assurance the project will become reality because of the dispute with the private Iowa Interstate Railroad. To say you're going to vote for this because there's going to be a rail to Moline is false until that deal is made. Peoria could also be in line for its own train route. Beyond funding, the bill directs the IDOTs to study what improvements are needed at the Joliet station for it to become a hub that facilitates passenger traffic specifically to Peoria and other locations outside the Chicago area. That station sits in a busy corridor of Amtrak, Metra, and freight lines. Metra, Chicago's suburban rail agency, could be key to expanding the reach of passenger rail from Chicago. The bill specifies that Metra is allowed to reach agreements to provide service outside the Chicago area when it is deemed beneficial to the state. It also directs Metra to study expanding the Metra Electric Line, which currently ends in University Park, to Kankakee. It also codifies that Metra must allow South Shore Line trains, which are operated by the Northern Indiana Commuter Transportation District between South Bend and Millennium Park, to stop at Metra stations along the route. A key priority for lawmakers in the bill was supporting development near public transportation corridors and stops. The bill would allow transit agencies to buy, build, own, operate, or maintain sites for residential or commercial development. Areas for development would be within a half mile of a train station or 1/8 of a mile of a bus stop. The goal is to allow more people to live, work, or engage in economic activity with easy access to public transportation. Senator Ram Vilinin, the Senate sponsor of the bill, told Capital News Illinois he envisions more communities will adopt transit-friendly developments like Morton Grove in his district. The near-north suburb has built apartment buildings near its Metra station on the Milwaukee District North Line, which makes it easy for residents to access public transportation into the city. Morton Grove is investing in a Metra station to make it even more appealing and accessible, and they're doing it in collaboration with conjunction with developing residential property that is next to the Metra station. So if you are someone that works in the city of Chicago, wants to have access to the entertainment district, you can live in Morton Grove next to the Metra station. The bill also directs the new Northern Illinois Transit Authority to identify parcels of land owned by it or other transit agencies that can be used for transit-supportive development. A grant established in the bill aims to incentivize projects that allow people to use public transportation to access outdoor recreation. The annual grant program, which is subject to appropriation by state lawmakers, would go toward projects that expand operations of existing transit services or construct or improve infrastructure. Transit agencies, owners of public lands, and units of local government that facilitate outdoor recreation would be eligible for the grants. As lawmakers try to incentivize living near transit stops, they also are hoping to decrease people's dependence on cars. The bill would establish the People Over Parking Act that bans municipalities from establishing minimum parking requirements for a development that is within a half mile of a public transportation hub or 1/8 of a mile of a public transportation corridor. The bill defines a hub as a train station or the intersection of two or more bus routes that provide service every 15 minutes or less during peak commute hours. Corridors are a street with one or more bus routes with service every 15 minutes or less during peak commute times. The bill still allows developers to build private parking voluntarily, but municipalities cannot require them to provide a minimum number of spaces. Some communities will be early beneficiaries of projects under the bill. In Chicago, the bill appears to require NITA to rebuild a long-shuttered stop on the Blue Line at Central Avenue in the Austin neighborhood along the Eisenhower Expressway that has been closed since 1973. It also requires NITA to renovate or build a new Green Line stop in Englewood. One suburban project would receive more funding from NITA under the bill. It calls for allowing NITA to share the cost of bridge repairs along the Green Line outside of Chicago, which would only apply to Oak Park. Oak Park, River Forest, Forest Park, and Rosemont would also receive annual reimbursements from NITA for providing first responders that cover CTA-L stations in those communities. Cicero, Evanston, and Skokie, which also have L stations, were not included in the bill. A spokesperson for Senate President Don Harmon, a Democrat who lives in Oak Park and represents parts of River Forest and Forest Park, said Harmon did not request those cost-sharing agreements. On Metra, riders on the Rock Island line that ends in Joliet would be part of a regional rail scheduling program beginning in 2027 that is designed to improve transit access for residents in Will County and southwestern Cook County. Outside the Chicago area, the bill allows lawmakers next year to appropriate money from a downstate transit fund for IDOT to use as a grant for the Springfield Airport to help sustain daily commercial flights to and from O'Hare. The most controversial part of the bill deals with funding. Republican lawmakers argue the funds used to close a major budget gap would have otherwise gone to road projects, particularly downstate. Lawmakers estimate $860 million in new funding for public transit will come from redirecting sales tax revenue on motor fuel to public transportation operations, marking a substantial change in how the proceeds are used. Under current law, 64% of the sales taxes go into the road fund, and most of the rest goes into the state's general fund. Beginning next July, after the bill becomes law, 80% of the sales tax revenue will go towards public transportation, marking a dramatic shift away from road projects. Of the sales tax revenue going toward a public transportation, 85% will be dedicated to the Chicago region. That was a conversation that evolved over time, and you know that fund is for transportation, and public transit is an issue that falls within transportation in our state, Vivillon said, pushing back against Republican criticism that the money should be reserved for road work. Motor fuel tax revenue, which is separate from sales tax revenue on motor fuel sales, will continue going into the road fund. The bill also calls for directing 90% of the expected $200 million in interest generated in the road fund to NITA, leaving 10% for the rest of the state. Transit agencies outside The Chicago area will be getting more funding through a formula that takes sales tax revenue collected in areas served by transit agencies and deposits it into the Downstate Public Transportation Fund. Agencies will be able to receive up to 80% of funding for operating expenses from the fund, an increase from the 65% mark that has been in place since 2008. The bill and the shift in funding away from downstate has left a rift between some labor organizations, particularly at the Laborers International Union of North America. Dustin Ramage, a representative at the Downstate Union, told Capital News Illinois the union is ending its affiliation with the Illinois AFL-CIO. Their officials were unhappy about the way AFL-CIO officials handled negotiations on the transit bill at the end of October. The AFL-CIO declined to comment. And finally, from the front page, U.S. increases military power in the Caribbean, from Washington. The nation's most advanced aircraft carrier arrived in the Caribbean Sea on Sunday in a display of U.S. military power, raising questions about what the new influx of troops and weaponry could signal for the Trump administration's drug enforcement campaign in South America. The arrival of the USS Gerald R. Ford, announced by the U.S. military in a news release, marks a major moment in what the Trump administration insists is a counter-drug operation, but has been seen as an escalating pressure tactic against Venezuelan President Maduro. Since early September, U.S. strikes have killed at least 80 people in 20 attacks on small boats accused of transporting drugs in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific Ocean. The Ford rounds off the largest buildup of U.S. firepower in the region in generations, bringing the total number of troops to about 12,000 on nearly a dozen Navy ships in what Defense Secretary Hegseth dubbed Operation Southern Spear. The Ford's carrier strike group, which includes squadrons of fighter jets and guided missile destroyers, transited the Anguilla Passage near the British Virgin Islands on Sunday morning, the Navy said in a statement. Rear Admiral Paul Lozada, who commands the Ford's carrier strike group, said it will bolster an already large force of American warships to protect our nation's security and prosperity against narco-terrorism in the Western Hemisphere. The administration has insisted that the buildup of warships is focused on stopping the flow of drugs into the U.S., but it has released no evidence to support its assertions that those killed in the boats were narco-terrorists. Trump indicated military action would expand beyond strikes by sea, saying the U.S. would stop the drugs coming in by land. The U.S. has long used aircraft carriers to pressure and deter aggression by other nations because their warplanes can strike targets deep inside another country. Some experts say the Ford is ill-suited to infighting cartels, but it could be an effective instrument of intimidation for Maduro in a push to get him to step down. Secretary of State Rubio says the United States does not recognize Maduro, who was widely accused of stealing last year's election, as Venezuela's legitimate leader. Rubio called Venezuela's government a transshipment organization that openly operates with those trafficking drugs. Maduro, who faces charges of narco-terrorism in the U.S., said the U.S. government is fabricating a war against him. Venezuela's government recently touted a massive mobilization of troops and civilians to defend against possible U.S. attacks. Trump justified the attacks on drug boats by saying the U.S. is in an armed conflict with drug cartels while claiming the boats are operated by foreign terror organizations. He has faced pushback from leaders in the region, the U.N. humanitarian rights chief, and U.S. lawmakers, including Republicans, who have pressed for more information on who is being targeted and the legal justification for the boat strikes. Senate Republicans, however, recently voted to reject legislation that would have put a check on Trump's ability to launch an attack against Venezuela without congressional authorization. Experts disagree on whether American warplanes may be used to strike land targets inside Venezuela. Either way, the 100,000-ton warship is sending a message. This is the anchor of what it means to have U.S. military power once again in Latin America, said Elizabeth Dickinson, the International Crisis Group senior analyst for the Andes region, and it has raised a lot of anxieties in Venezuela, but also throughout the region. I think everyone is watching this with sort of bated breath to see just how willing the U.S. is really ready to use military force. And from Chicago, buyout events backstreet vendors. City cyclists pull money and deliver food to shelters. The cyclists arrived at sunrise, rolling through Chicago's Latino neighborhoods and stopping at tamale carts, elote stands, and candy stalls. They buy out every last item, every tamale, every corn cob, every bundle of sweets. Then they load up the food and deliver it to shelters and families in need. Since the start of a federal immigration crackdown that has led to more than 3,200 arrests in the Chicago metropolitan area, streets and storefronts in the city's Latino neighborhoods have emptied out. Street vendors, fearing arrest, have been afraid to leave their homes to work. Local restaurants have struggled as customers stay home. But as fear spread, so did something else. Neighbors stepping up for one another and finding creative ways to support vendors and restaurant owners. This includes a grassroots effort to organize so-called buyout events meant to allow vendors who fear being detained by immigration agents to go home early. Some Chicagoans have pooled money in their neighborhoods or through local organizations, while others have bought out taco stands while on their way to work or tamale vendors outside their local bars. In Little Village, Rick Rosales, community organizer with Cycling Solidarity, helps organize two of these buyout rides per week. The vendors are often speechless, he said. They'll say, I have a lot of tamales. You want all of them? Once, after the group bought out a tamale vendor's cart, that man found them days later to say immigration agents had been spotted on his block just hours after. You saved my life, Rosales said. The man told them. This is about food and joy and bike rides, Rosales said. So it's also so incredibly high stakes because the fear in our communities right now. It's hard to say how many street vendors have been targeted by federal immigration agents, said Maria Oxo, outreach organizer for the Street Vendors Association of Chicago, adding she knows of at least 10 who have been detained. In September, a tamale vendor was detained while selling outside a Home Depot. Soon after, federal agents arrested a flower seller in the southwest neighborhood of Archer Heights. Then they came for a cotton candy vendor in the predominantly Mexican-American Little Village. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the Department of Homeland Security, and U.S. Customs and Border Protection did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Oxo said losing these vendors is as much a cultural loss as an economic one, calling them part of the fabric of our city. She said they bring life, color, and flavor to the city streets, preserving culinary traditions and building a sense of community, and they are beloved by neighbors. Street vendors who are afraid to work or are seeing drops in sales can apply for financial support through the Street Vendors Association of Chicago. Oxo said local businesses have also hosted pop-up events where a certain percentage of proceeds goes to street vendors. The organization has also helped connect vendors to people hoping to buy them out. Delilah Martinez, a community organizer and owner of the Vault Gallery in Pilsen, couldn't stand the silence on her streets anymore. She was used to seeing familiar faces on 18th Street, a woman selling candy with her baby strapped to her back, a bolero who smiled at her each afternoon. Then one week, they were gone. It broke my heart. The streets felt empty. Our people were putting their freedom at risk just to go to work. She began raising money online and started Operation Buyout, approaching vendors one by one to purchase everything they had. The first woman was shocked when Martinez handed her $500. I just wanted her to have a day of rest, a day without fear. Among those Martinez helped recently was a baker from Mexico City who arrived in Chicago 24 years ago. Each night he works late, kneading dough. For those few quiet hours after his four children are asleep, the world seems simpler. "There is a magic when I'm baking," he said in Spanish. "I feel free. When I'm angry, I feel like the bread will absorb it. So I try to be happy and at peace, even when I know the reality is different." By 3 a.m., he's up again for his grocery store shift, juggling work and school drop-offs. For years, he's sold birthday cakes and pan dulce by word of mouth from his small kitchen, dreaming of one day opening his own shop. But he's also heard the stories: street vendors arrested on residential streets, and federal agents circling his historically Mexican-American neighborhood of Pilsen. Two of his friends have been detained. "I'm afraid for my youngest daughter," he said. "It would be horrible to leave her. I can't see myself without my children." Martinez led the baker to a table and pulled off a black cloth. A silver restaurant-grade mixer gleamed under the fluorescent light. Martinez also handed him an envelope with $1,500, gathered from neighbors hoping to help support him when he feels unsafe selling his baked goods in the street. The man's hand flew up to cover his mouth. He kicked his legs and began to cry. "Thank you so much," he said, clutching a mixer attachment to his chest. "It's beautiful." And from the local page, Shelter adds cat spay neuter clinic from Normal. Pad Central Helps, a nonprofit animal shelter based in Normal, is now offering a low-cost cat spay and neuter clinic through its Pet Fix team. The goal of the program is to help pet owners in historically underserved communities and those who live in a veterinary desert, according to a news release from Pet Central Helps. Spaying and neutering also helps to mitigate overpopulation in local animal shelters by preventing accidental kitten litters, according to the organization. The clinic will also accept community cats who have been trapped by individuals caring for them. The Pet Fix team will offer an option to add age-appropriate vaccinations or booster shots, microchipping, flea prevention, or ear tipping to appointments. This community desperately needs affordable vet care solutions. Being able to provide an option for pet owners who want to get their pets high-quality care at a reasonable price is paramount to our mission of meeting companion animals and their owners where they are at. Those who are interested in setting up an appointment can visit online to fill out a brief application providing information on the pet and services needed. A team member will reach out via email to set up an appointment. An appointment that includes a spay-neuter procedure, rabies vaccine, and FVRCP vaccine will be $125. Pet Central Helps will offer a lower cost of $65 for those eligible for the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, who can provide their eligibility letter. Finally, Oha Shaw of Bloomington was one of 10 Illinois 4-H members recognized as a 2025 Illinois Sustaining the Future Award recipient. The awards recognize members who exemplify outstanding leadership in the agricultural industry and demonstrate a desire to remain engaged. The honorees are invited to attend the Premier 20 Leadership Conference, an elite youth leadership and professional opportunity held April 27th, 28th, 2026 in Bloomington. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Bloomington Pentagraph for Monday, November 17th. Please stay tuned.